today. So with that, I think we are ready to start. I'd like to introduce Tom Bogdan to you, who's the president of UCAR. Tom, go
ahead. Thank you. Let's see if we can get this first PowerPoint up here. I think the lighting's fine. Good morning, everyone. I'm the leadoff batter for the UCAR team. I want to start with a horrible joke. It may or may not work here, but listening to the background of all of the individuals, I was just humbled by the experience that's out here in our audience from Canada and just the breadth of knowledge and expertise and accomplishments. And so I'll make a parody of a famous joke we have in the U.S. that the last time this amount of intellectual horsepower was assembled in this room was when Sir Ernest Rutherford had lunch alone by himself, possibly with Jamie Goodall with him, because it would have been about 105 years ago. I have about 15 minutes to explain one thing to you, really, and one thing only, and that is, what is the difference between NCAR and UCAR? And we may as well get that right up front, because we struggle with that ourselves, and I struggled with it for quite a long time. So this slide is to help explain the difference in a way that hopefully will make sense to you. So we have three intersecting spheres of influence here. And let's start with the one you know the best, which is NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. NCAR was formed in 1960 as the first federally funded research and development center of the National Science Foundation. Today, it remains one of five FFRDCs, as we call them, of the NSF. It is the largest, it is the broadest in scope, and it is by far the most well-known. Three of them, other than NCAR, deal with astronomical issues of various sorts, and the fifth one is sort of a defense think tank type economics organization. So in many ways, we are the anchor or flagship federally funded research and development center of the National Science Foundation. So what is UCAR? In its wisdom, when the National Science Foundation and many university professors got together in 1960, they decided that the NSF was not willing to operate this FFRDC on their own. They required some other party to do that, nor were they going to allow the National Center to operate itself. So what was required was a third party, separate from the NSF and separate from NCAR, that would have the contract from the National Science Foundation to operate this National Center for NSF. So 14 university professors came together in the late 1950s to incorporate an organization that they called UCAR, the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, with one and only one purpose: to be that entity that managed the National Center for Atmospheric Research on behalf of the National Science Foundation. So the first UCAR contained one employee who also happened to be the director of NCAR, and his name was Walter Orr Roberts. And so if there's a sense that UCAR and NCAR were indistinguishable, it was because at its origins they really were. Now, time has flown by, and every 5 years, the National Science Foundation considers who they will ask to operate their crown jewel, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And since 1960, UCAR has consistently been selected by the NSF to do that. The current five-year cooperative agreement, as we call it, between the National Science Foundation and UCAR will end in September 30 of 2018. And so we will then be preparing for potentially a recompetition of that cooperative agreement. So on my calendar as president, I have this big star around September of 2018 because I have to pay attention for that renewal of that agreement. Over the years, UCAR has increased in scope, and today we're much more of a thick client, UCAR. They no longer would entrust the operation of the National Center to me. We have Jim Hurl here to do that instead. And in addition to the National Center, which focuses primarily on the research, not totally, but it's driven by the science research, a group of activities called UCAR's Community Programs has grown up around the National Center in the same way that suburbs might grow around a city center, that they add to the vitality, that they interact, they mix. And what UCAR's Community Programs are about, and Emily Kobabe Amon is the director of that activity, is really trying to take those research, the basic research ideas, and find ways to move them slowly towards applications, towards things that help society, that help us living on a changing planet, figure out how to make good decisions around living on that changing planet. They connect to the operational community, which has the mandate often to provide that information very clearly to users who depend on it. We do not do operations at UCAR, by and large. We are not an operational entity that people depend upon us for services in the same way they may get from Environment Canada or from the National Weather Service in the U.S. But we feel we can be an important conduit in that chain of allowing that research to move from one end to the other. That's our unique niche that a UCAR that is built around the National Center as the hub or downtown of this intellectual city adds value. The final circle here, of course, are our university members. UCAR is a consortium of universities, and the universities exercise governance over UCAR. The National Science Foundation does not exercise governance over UCAR. It has governance over its national center in many ways, and that's an interesting partnership between the operating agency, the community, the national center, and the NSF. But the governance of the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research is vested in our member universities. And we have 103 of them today, as opposed to the 14 that we began with in 1960. And it's important to point out, and that's why we're here today, three of those universities are in Canada. Toronto, McGill, and York are three Canadian universities. Our bylaws, those that charter under which we were incorporated, permits us to admit governing members from the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But currently we have no members from Mexico, and we have three from Canada and 100 in the U.S. We collaborate internationally very strongly, but our international collaborations do not provide the governance. Membership in UCAR allows our members to elect our Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees in turn chooses me or my equivalent as the president of the organization, and therefore the management of the National Center comes through the universities through that governance process. There's our iconic building in Boulder, Colorado. Many of you have been there. It was designed by the architect I.M. Pei before he became famous for the pyramid in front of the Louvre in Paris. Pei is still alive. He lives in New York, kitty corner to Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General. And when we had the UN Secretary General visiting us, he was very delighted to find out that his next-door neighbor had, in fact, designed this building way back in the early 1960s. It's reaching its 50th anniversary, and for those of you who have been there recently, you know that while the outside remains beautiful and iconic, the idea here was to be based on the idea of the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde. The inside is in much need of refurb, and this is not a very green building at all. In the 1960s, we didn't think about our carbon footprint, did we? And so it's sometimes a little embarrassing to think that in Bill Large's group, some of the great forward-thinking ideas about climate change are taking place in a building where we are not very much paying attention to our role in climate change. We manage NCAR and UCAR's community programs. Oops. Need to go this way. We are very much a hub, a nexus where people come together. I like to think of our organization and Boulder as being kind of that oasis on the Silk Road of atmospheric and related sciences where travelers, researchers who are weary perhaps from their research journeys come to spend a day, a week, a month, a year. Some have never left. They found it so enticing to be there. But we can create community, and that's something that we do very well. Our overall budget is just under $250 million a year, and we have a staff of about 1,300 people. And this is the combined National Center for Atmospheric Research, UCAR's community programs, and the rest of UCAR that does the business development underneath it. We're primarily based in Colorado, but we also have locations in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where our supercomputing center is, Mauna Loa, Hawaii, on the Big Island, where we have a solar observatory that we've had up there, just right next to the NOAA site, where the Keeling Curve comes from since really the mid-1960s. And most recently, we've opened an office in Washington, D.C., that we share with the Ocean Leadership Group, which really, in my way of thinking, comes back to a comment that was made here that the atmosphere and the ocean communities need to work together because climate is both an atmosphere and an ocean working in concert on a variety of timescales. So one of my strategies over the last 2 years or so has been to reach out to our colleagues in ocean sciences and look for common areas where we can work together in the U.S. And it may be something that is very doable in Canada as well. Some of our strengths, and I'm highlighting them because you're going to hear about each of these in more detail. First of all, our supercomputing center, our Yellowstone computer is a 1.7 petaflop machine that was 13th fastest on the planet when it was inaugurated a couple Octobers back. We have two aircraft that we operate. We have a fleet of satellites in space thanks to the COSMIC program, and we develop many sorts of sensors for measuring atmospheric parameters. We are famous for two open source community-led models. They've been mentioned here as we've gone around the room. The Community Earth System model focuses on climate and climate scale activities, and our weather research forecast model that focuses on the shorter time scale weather activities. We have our observatory in Hawaii, you'll hear more about that, that brings down real-time solar data of the corona. But what I do want to point out for you, and there are copies of our view graphs outside, in fact, if you want to pick them up at some point, but write down this word open sky. Open Sky is a wonderful initiative that the National Center has taken that really relates back to President Obama's idea that ideas, information, content that the American taxpayer has paid for should be available to everyone, including that American taxpayer, whether or not he or she knows what to do with it, but it should be available for them. And Open Sky is our attempt to take virtually everything that NCAR has done in its 54-year history and make it available in one way, shape, or form, be it technical notes, data sets, papers where we don't run into issues with journals and copyright charges and things of that nature. It's a great effort. Lots of historic photographs. So Google Open Sky and put NCAR after it. Otherwise, you end up with the Delta Airlines frequent flyer program. But just put an NCAR there. And when you're bored sometime, when you're stuck on a Delta Airlines flight and see the sorts of things that we have out there, it's amazing. We continue to build to that. And we won't say, I think, any more about Open Sky and what we do here. Our applications that sit on UCAR's community program side, which Emily will address more, involve Unidata. We have Mohan here. He's got a whole section on that. Comet, many of you have been involved with Comet since the very beginning, our online learning modules. All of this is free and open to anyone. COSMIC, our GPS satellite system. Many of you have worked through our Visiting Scientist program that allows postdoctoral fellows to take positions at various places around the globe, and we do the administration on the UCAR side. It's often easier than federal agencies sometimes trying to administer those programs, and that's why VSP has been a huge effort. And finally, very important, the role that we can play in curricula development and promoting materials and activities for teachers in K through 12 or in Canada, we'd say K through 13, right? Because you have an extra year here. Not anymore. No more K through 13. Oops. Unidata, for instance, as Mohan will tell you, delivers real-time weather data to universities all over the planet. And he will share many more statistics with you about that. So I'm just highlighting what you're going to see coming up. Another great activity, of course, is our MetEd, now moving into both French and Spanish languages for our modules. I remember the famous statistic Rich gave me, which I thought was fantastic, is if you opened up a Comet module today and started going through them, and you went continuously through his catalog and did not sleep, go to the bathroom, or eat, you would spend 1 month total in front of your computer before you got to the end of the amount of material that is there in Comet. And this is free, available to everyone. And Rich will show you that students across the globe are the largest users of the Comet material, both in a structured classroom environment, but also learning on their own. Amazing graphic displays. UCAR Connect is another great website for you to check out. We have the pleasure and privilege of having many, many distinguished researchers come through Boulder in the course of their travels. And when they're there, we ask them to give colloquia, talks, seminars on what they've done. And we're now in the process of trying to take each and every one of those talks that takes place in one of our large six auditoriums, and as we're doing today, stream it live. Stream it live so that people can watch them, put it on YouTube so that students later on can go hear Carrie Emanuel, say, talk about his research on hurricanes. Carrie may not make it to many of our 103 schools for whatever reason, but thanks to the ability that we have to use the IT that's available today, we can put that out there so that students can be watching those things. We have live broadcasts. Often we have panels and interviews that are there. So check out our UCAR Connect is an area where we try to take some of the intellectual excitement that's happening at our National Center and open it up and make it visible to others. We have a lot of opportunities for students and professionals to come and spend time with us. Summer is a great season, but we're not limited to summer. And our opportunities page, ucar.edu/opportunities, is your one-stop shop, no matter where you are in your career, to understanding what is available at this moment. And many of those activities are not restricted to U.S. citizens. And we're focusing here today on the things we'll show you, in particular to the things that are widely available internationally and not restricted to the U.S. Our summer internships are a great way for students to come in a variety of different areas, get some hands-on experience working with some of our staff, our engineers, our scientists, but more important often is socializing with other students from different backgrounds, from different aptitudes, from different social experiences, and starting to form that network that you know is so important to your career because you need your network to help you through. Another great example is our engineering research activities. We find increasingly that it's hard to get students trained in hands-on experimental design of instrumentation. Instruments have become huge, expensive, hard to do, take many years. And so this has been a great program for offering students the opportunity to come in and really start soldering things, you know, working on some of that instrumentation that helps to build those skills that they will need in the future if they go off and become instrumental designers at universities and bring up that next generation. And again, many of these things we pay for. We have stipends, we bring funding for travel. Many of these we support with very little need for the student to bring their own funds to it. Moving on to graduate fellowships and postdocs, we support many graduate fellowships. Jim will say more about that in his activity. The NCAR Advanced Study Program is really, I would say, the gem within NCAR. If you look at the leaders of our community who have come through the ASP program, it's mind-boggling. Virtually everyone who's anyone has gone through. How many of you were ASP postdocs at one point? All right, a couple of hands go up. It is a privileged group. We get about 100 applications for about 8 to 10 positions a year. So the rate of getting in there is really hard. But this is an amazing program in the sense that you come and you can do whatever you want as an ASP program, postdoc, literally. You're not forced to work on a certain activity, but you get to explore and sample what the National Center can do. It's a great way to pick a different area. You know, after your thesis, typically you've got so many papers you want to write on everything you did. And it's tempting to do that, but taking another 2 years to learn another area, to learn another capacity, maybe another method, makes you a double threat, makes your career so much stronger to be able to apply in two different areas. So many of our ASP postdocs are taking this opportunity to dive into something new. Maybe it's somewhat related to their thesis. Maybe if they did a model thesis, they look at data analysis as part of a complementary approach. But it helps to broaden their career. And I think it's one of the few postdoctoral programs is not tied to a specific topic you need to work on. We have visiting scientist programs. Again, opportunities/opportunities is where you go to find out about all these things. We have workshops. We heard from a gentleman in the back who came for our Linda Mearns operated workshop this summer, which was great, around our community models, training workshops related to how to make the most of these models that are there, and state of the science workshops on different topics, the topics du jour that we come up with each year that we want to investigate and try to bring the community together to think about them. And these, again, wide open, typically 1, 2, 3 weeks in the summer when it's fairly easier for you to get away. Moving on to seasoned professionals, we're looking at exchanges where we send our staff out to universities and we bring university people into our organization. I've gone out and visited 37 of my member universities so far, and one of the things that I hear ubiquitously is, we love coming to Boulder. It's a beautiful place. We like it, but why the heck don't you people come see us? Our school is nice, too. We have a lot of cool things going on here, and if you spend some time with us, all of my grad students and postdocs can start to learn from you. So we started the U-Visit program to do just that, and this is one of our scientists, Malshumi Digpati from HAO, who went off to Dartmouth for a semester and taught a space weather course in residence at Dartmouth. Often some of our early career faculty would love to come to your universities and teach a course or two, particularly the graduate level. We don't want to throw them into, you know, atmospheric science 101 or something where, you know, they're going to have to psychologically manage a crowd of, you know, ruthless people on their iPads. But something, you know, we want to start them off easily, right? But it's good for them because when my early career scientists want to apply for jobs at the university, one of the things they always run into is, what's your teaching experience? Today, to make it in the university community, you not only have to be a great researcher, but you've got to be able to get up in front of a classroom and convey that information. Both are important now. And this helps our scientists to do that. When we send some of our older scientists, it helps us to share some of our knowledge about what we're doing and bring that knowledge back. So again, opportunities is the place to look for this. Finally, I'm going to mention under opportunities as well is the NSF's Lower Atmosphere Observing Facilities booklet that sets out all the lower atmospheric observing facilities that are available for different researchers to propose to use through the NSF as part of campaigns. And I know Jim will say more about some of these opportunities as well, how to make a request. Great place to go. You can download this booklet. Many of these are open internationally. We just came back from a campaign in New Zealand where we were working on looking at gravity wave development. So, my final comment here. You know the difference between NCAR and UCAR. We are really that nexus on the Silk Road of science. Come spend time with us. Have us come spend time with you. There's two websites for you to remember. UCAR Connect allows you to tap into the daily intellectual environment of what's happening at our organization. and opportunities allows you to find ways to put yourself physically in that picture. Your students, your postdocs, even your undergrads can be part of what we do. And again, what we feel we can do is really sit at that midway point between the different aspects of the sector, of the weather, climate, atmosphere sector. And we make that pledge every day in our country, and what our Washington office does is works hard to make that value proposition to our leadership in the U.S. as to why an investment in the kind of research you do is not something where we should be saving pennies, that it is being penny wise and pound foolish to cut back on the research activities that are going to help us all figure out how to live on this changing planet going forward. So, that's it for my presentation. Just a quick overview. Any questions about UCAR in general? Yeah, Jim?
Thanks very much, Tom. And that last slide really reminded me of the outcome of the panel sessions we had at the World Weather Science Conference with respect to partnerships and really the evolution of the weather enterprise. And I've certainly admired the leadership that UCAR has had in knowledge and technology transfer, certainly in my relationship with UCAR. Now that I'm retired, I'm doing a little bit of work with the private sector, the media, and the provinces. And my observation is that there's very limited scientific capacity in certainly some of those organizations. I know the provinces, for example, that I deal with have very limited capacity on the science side. And I guess my question is, on the partnership work that you're doing, are you or do you plan on targeting or making an effort in developing a relationship with the states, the private sector, the media, whether it be in the USA or in other countries?
Absolutely. So as we've seen federal funding in the U.S. take a dip, we've had to look how to balance our portfolio, and what that's told us is that we need more partnerships across more diverse sectors. So we've begun working with states. My interest in Canada started when I met the Premier of Manitoba, who came down for the Western Governors Association meeting in Salt Lake City 2 years back. The state of Colorado gave us $2 million, gave NCAR $2 million this year, that then it sent out to universities to support our Front Range air pollution and photochemistry experiment along the Front Range. So we are looking to states. States have needs around water, fire weather, air quality are big issues for states, particularly in the West. We also are working with the private sector. Many companies have gotten rid of or downscaled or even eliminated their internal R&D facilities. The idea that they could leverage funded activities that the U.S. federal government or states may be providing funding to boost their capability at a smaller cost is something that we're looking at as well. And then finally, reaching out to foundations. I really do think that in today's scheme, foundations again start to become, as they were in Rutherford's time, foundations were the funding mechanism for science. They become so again today, given kind of this strange economic situation we have where all of the money goes to a small group of people. But you know, interestingly enough, some of those people care about the planet and how it's going to be after they're gone. So we need to make all those connections. And again, as a not-for-profit, as the UCAR part, not the NCAR part, we feel we're very well positioned to be able to open those dialogues on behalf of our national center. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Rachel?
I just have a comment, actually. So if you're interested in finding out more about the opportunities that Tom has talked about, and you haven't had a chance to pick up this folder, there's the list of opportunities as well as the agenda and other information in that folder, so feel free to grab one.
Tom?
Yes?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great successes, and Jim has already mentioned it, was the role of COMET for training forecasters. This is something I appreciate from that for the National Weather Service. What is the strategy for UCAR and NCAR to try to develop a relationship and a collaborative approach with the Weather Service to develop a weather prediction system?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a strategy or you just feel that it's not your, the place you should play a role?
No, we do, but I'm going to let Rich and Emily address that during their parts of the talk. So the National Weather Service and Environment Canada both sit on the governing board for COMET. And in that capacity, this last year we had a number of really good discussions. The BOM is there as well from Australia, and they are working, you know, very hard to figure out what is the new strategy for integrating this within the national services, but also for the other people who are making use of it. So I'm going to defer that question to them. Do you want to grab it now? Would it be helpful to have the answer now? Because you have to leave partway through. So, Rich, why don't you go ahead and take that?
Yeah,
use your mic.
Yeah, the strategy is that we are going to convert over the next 10 years to where we are more integrated with the all phases of the development of the professional workforce, starting with the academia, and then doing products and services that are directly supportive of the academic delivery of new science content. Then that will transition into media development for the professional workforce that's tailored to the new tools and techniques that they're going to use, because we've reduced the workforce out in the operational sector down to where their time for training is much shorter than it used to be. So we're retailoring all of our products and services into a much shorter time snippet of just-in-time training focused on what they need to know as they change from seasonal, you know, requirements and so forth in the forecast job on, you know, on shift. We're also shifting over to a competency-based outcome that will include more simulations, and it will be associated with, you know, adult learning construct of applying in near real time, you know, new concepts and techniques in a simulation environment to reinforce the retention of learning. So, and I'll get into more detail on how that's going to work.
And I'm back.
Yeah, I had a little comment. Obviously, this is ultimately all about money, right? And you've mentioned various sources, and governments are cutting back funding, businesses. The governments tell us to go to the businesses. The businesses say, well, you know, we'll fund you, but we need to know this in 2 years' time, and we're doing research that has a 10 or 20-year time frame, so that doesn't work either. So the big, real funders that are left are the few multi-billion-dollar millionaires, billionaires in the world. That's, and you mentioned foundations, and that's really where it all comes down to. Now, you go to one of those foundations and ask for money, they'll have billions of dollars for medicine. That's our main competitor. But we have to convince people that research in the atmosphere is important, and a lot of people have the feeling, well, it's obvious, we just, the air's right outside, how hard can it be? We had a recent tornado where the people who were damaged by the tornado said, why weren't we warned? Why aren't we, these people should be able to tell us about it. So there's this idea that it's around us, as we can see it, it's easy to study. So the big issue is, two issues, we've got to convince people in the public that, hey, it is actually hard to study the atmosphere, it's not obvious. And B, we have to convince these people who think they're going to put all their money into medicine that putting it into weather is just as important, and that's harder than it seems. So, you know, there's no question our future funding is the foundations, as you say, but there's also this PR angle of convincing them that it's worthwhile. I'm just wondering if you had a comment about that.
You're absolutely spot on with your analysis, and we have not gone to the foundations asking for money. We've started by working with the private sector because they understand that so much of their bottom line are decisions that they make over the sort of 1 month to two decade time scale, where they may situate plants, where they may carry out activities, and they understand that edge. So what we're beginning to see from a variety of industries, transportation, insurance, and others, is a desire to have better information on the seasonal to interannual time scale. So it's this midway place between climate and weather that has inspired a lot of interest. At that point, they are willing to come forward and start to put dollars behind some of these things and to lobby for those activities. It's much stronger for us to have a shipping company go to the Congress and say, you bet I'm losing money on these snowstorms in Atlanta. I needed to know 2 days in advance to route around there. I didn't have that information. I lost this amount. Even Janet Yellen, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, took the first quarter impacts that we saw in the U.S. economy when we had the fairly severe winter down in the States and attributed that to weather and the impacts of weather and the importance of being able to get those forecasts out. So I think on the private sector, there's a growing awareness that this is important and that it needs to be invested in. We need to bring that together and show the connections between weather and health, weather and food security, weather and water security, because water security, food security, health are the sorts of things that many of the current foundations, as you point out, want to pay attention to, but they are driven by those climatic and weather changes. So it's not an easy road to hoe, but I think we've got great material as a field. We've got a lot of impacts, and we just have to be consistent in our message and keep working it. John?
Just one really quick follow-up point to this issue. We do a lot of, you do a lot of outreach to younger kids trying to convey the excitement of our science and so forth. It seems to me that one of the big issues in trying to secure funding from foundations and even the public sector is to provide outreach to the overall public about what we as a science can do. What can be done at that level? I mean, there's a lot of educational outreach, but a lot of it is earmarked towards elementary, middle school, and high school kids. But at the same time, I think there's an urgent need to provide outreach to the general public.
This is something that Emily and her team focus on quite a bit. So I don't know, Emily, if you want to give a quick answer here or come back to it in your talk.
Well, I think I can say a couple of things. You know, certainly while we have, you know, within UCP we have five programs that range from wheels on the ground, public education and outreach programs to the kinds of competency trainings that Comet does. Increasingly, we're finding that the public outreach piece of this is both very difficult and probably one of the most important, because it is the way that we begin to change societal impressions, right? UCAR Connect was actually established to be a primary public outreach portal for not just the science that NCAR does, but the science that UCAR institutions do, and really a platform for atmospheric and climate sciences as it goes out to the public. And so when you go to that site, it is a place where you find everything on a particular topic that you need, okay, that everybody from like a weather geek kind of high-end user all the way down to my 12-year-old son can find what he needs. Now the challenge is to get that kind of form integrated into other kinds of outlets. And the ways that we've been doing that, things like partnering with the Weather Company, where they will begin to incorporate UCAR Connect into their online presence, which hits about 1 billion people a year. And so it's through this kind of pushing out and actively pushing out that we're hoping to be able to start moving the dial. But it's out of all the kinds of education public outreach that you can do, this is the most difficult, right? Because of the variety of folks and users that you have out there and the preconceptions that they come to the conversation with. But that's at least where we're starting.
Thank you, Tom. So we've covered some of the area of outreach quite, and we're launching the discussion in the right direction, I believe. There's one aspect, though, which will be a big challenge in the coming decade, is related to high-performance computing and the management of large data sets. How do we want to collaborate in order to make the best and optimal use of that? So do you want, you or Al could actually make a few comments now to launch future discussion on that?
We will be covering some of that under Mohan's part of the discussion as well as Jim's. But Al, if you want to say something to respond, please.
I'm dumbfounded as to how to respond. It's a huge problem. We have our plate full just managing. Well, we've accumulated over 32 petabytes of data in our archival storage. And that is an enormous challenge, not only for just sustaining the archival of it, but giving easy access to that kind of data sets. For much of history, the metadata hasn't been created for a lot of that that's in there, so it's kind of blind holdings. we're moving very strongly towards trying to look at ways in which we could, one of the ways which we could collaborate would be to, for both of us to use a private cloud, put our data in behind the cloud and use some commercial infrastructure that front ends that cloud, and then plug in our own APIs, our own analysis systems into that ABI, so that we don't all have to develop or adopt one single analysis tool, but yet we would be able to access through cloud-based resources this kind of infrastructure. We have developed a small private cloud to try and test this to see if it'll work with some of our member universities who have their own analysis tools. We have our own analysis tools, and can we build this kind of an infrastructure and test it out? First, we'll build this prototype. But that's one of the ways in which we might be able to collaborate on these kinds of things.
Let's take just one more question, then I have to let Jim get up here.
Yeah, one thing that I guess concerns me is that in many ways there's, I think, an intellectual infrastructure associated with what's behind the science, sort of supporting the new students, supporting the new activities. And a lot of what we're talking about sees science as being applied, where science is also a driver in many cases. And I find that is a message that's very, very difficult to communicate, because often people want to see, well, why are you doing this, whereas a lot of research doesn't show up until later, and it has enormous implications for the you know, what ends up happening. So the funding and the getting at that aspect of things always seems to me to be taken for granted. It's a bit like the plumbing in the streets and so on, and when it goes wrong, if you haven't been fixing it, then there's a, you know, disaster later on. So I don't know whether there's thoughts. I find it a difficult thing at our university to get at as well, but whether you have any thoughts on that side of things. So.
I have a lot of thoughts on that, because that's more or less what I spend my time doing, is trying to figure out how to take what we're doing and package it in a way that a staffer in Washington will look at it and go, you bet, that's a good investment. I get it. And I'm not going to expect something in 3 weeks, but how you build out that long time scale. And there are a number of techniques to do that, and I think perhaps best might be that we sit down over lunch, and I'll be happy to kind of share some of them with you. But it's where it separates, you know, from the good jobs from the bad jobs, is getting that right, because currently governments cannot be that patient. They have a lot of impatience in what they're doing, and yet, as you all know, you don't sit down and solve a problem this morning because you decide you're going to solve it. Doesn't work that way. And getting that message across is important. Yeah. All right, I'm going to turn it over to Jim Hurl and Carl.